Is there a place in time where logic breaks down and wonderment begins? Could that be somewhere or sometime along an indefinable line between the reasonable and the highly unlikely? Join us on a journey into the improbable.
Today's story, episode 230, Lifeblood. Read by Mitchell Two. Opening and closing theme by Matthew Erdman. Somewhere and sometime, you might be forced to sell your future. Dakari picked at his food with a silver fork, distracted by a new liver spot on the back of his hand that hadn't been there a month ago. In the last week, the excruciating back pain had started, and the finger joints on his right hand had become arthritic. He had been assured the symptoms would go away as soon as his body manufactured enough new something or other. Mr. Camp's medical team had explained the process and side effects in obscure technical terms, pointedly not bothering to translate them into something a layperson or an 11-year-old from the slums of Dharavi, Mumbai could comprehend. Despite the intentional obfuscation, Dakari understood enough to know his organs needed time to make the whatevers, but they were also what Mr. Camp's aging body needed. They were why Camp was paying his family enough money to get them out of the slums, and why he was here.
"Eat up, boy," Mr. Camp encouraged.
Did the 89-year-old look any better? Dakari wondered. He wasn't quite as stooped, and the limp he noticed when they first met was almost gone. Dakari winced as he tried to close his right hand, wondering how much he had given up elsewhere in his body for Camp's modest improvements. The old man had gotten into the habit of checking on him every morning to ensure he was sticking to the diet his consultants had prescribed.
"What goes into you goes into me, and I only want the best," Camp said the same thing every time he checked on Dakari.
He stretched his arms and back as he watched the boy trying to avoid the bits of artichoke on his plate.
"They're called artichokes," Camp noted sarcastically, "and they're full of fiber, calcium, iron, phosphorus, and potassium. You've got to eat them. It's part of the contract. Or..." He trailed off, not needing to complete the implicit threat.
Camp made it any time Dakari didn't do exactly as he was told. Follow the instructions exactly, or he'd pull out of the agreement, send Dakari and his family back to the slums, and look for another kid. Although Dakari was beginning to doubt just how likely it was for Mr. Camp to follow through. He had overheard the lead doctor on the medical team telling Camp how hard it was to find another genetic match. That tidbit had emboldened Dakari to make small, defiant gestures, like not eating the artichokes, or other things which irritated the old man without putting his family at risk. The clinic was located on the second floor of the sprawling villa overlooking the Mediterranean Sea. Dakari liked to watch the rollers come in and dream of sailing, something Camp had claimed was too dangerous for the boy to ever do. There were far too many things deemed too dangerous, Dakari lamented. Sometimes it felt like he had no freedom whatsoever. He was schooled by a personal tutor, played with carefully screened kids who weren't allowed to come in if they had even a hint of a sniffle. On top of that, there was the list of prohibited activities. He could only bike on the villa's grounds, on a specially made trail, and play non-contact sports. He was surprised he wasn't wrapped in plastic bubble wrap on the rare occasion he was allowed to leave the villa with a security escort. Upon arrival at the clinic on the third floor, Dakari found the technicians already at work, setting up the parabiosis equipment, consisting of two inclined, side-by-side beds connected by tubes, pumps, and beeping electronics.
The beds were positioned in the middle of the room and angled so a person lying on them could look out of the large windows facing onto the Mediterranean Sea. The process took several hours a day, so Camp had ensured that the clinic felt more like a health spa than a hospital. However, even his money couldn't disguise the rack of complicated machines and monitors at the heart of the room. One of the technicians, a thin woman with dark hair and friendly eyes in a lab coat, noticed Dakari watching them from the door.
"Hi, Dakari. Come on in. We're ready for you."
Eva motioned him over to one of the beds.
"Mr. Camp will be here in a few minutes, so we should get you hooked up."
"No, I need to..."
Dakari protested, standing his ground.
"You know how angry he gets if we're not ready," Eva reminded him. "Plus, I've got a treat for you if you follow all our instructions today."
Dakari liked the woman. She was the only staff member who treated him more like a human than a source of medicinal material for their employer. The other techs avoided talking to him and turned away when he tried to engage them. Eva was different, and he was glad she was here today. Reluctantly, Dakari climbed on to the right bed.
"Thank you," Eva smiled.
She nodded to the other tech, who began switching on machines.
"You know the drill, Dakari. Please, give me your arm."
Dakari slowly let his left arm flop to his side, palm up, exposing the place on his forearm where two capped shunts had been surgically implanted in the main artery and vein. With practiced ease, Eva took off the elastic bandage that protected them, then connected two clear plastic tubes which ran from Dakari's arm into the rack of machinery.
"I'm here. Let's get going," Camp interrupted, walking confidently into the clinic, throwing himself down on the open bed, then rolling up his sleeve.
The other technician immediately hooked up tubes to a pair of shunts in his right forearm.
"Well, what are you waiting for? Let's start," Camp demanded. "I've got meetings this afternoon."
He lay his head back and stared at the ceiling where a flat screen had been installed. Dakari watched Eva open the valves attached to his shunts, and his blood rushed down the tube into the bowels of the machinery before it raced down another tube into Camp's arm. In return, he watched Camp's ancient blood rush back up the second tube, through the machines, and into his body. He could almost feel the tired old cells invading, bringing with them the acid of age to eat away at his heart, lungs, joints, and skin, encouraging his body to make the stuff which kept the old man alive. He didn't understand how it all worked. Before his parents had agreed to let him become a donor, Camp's representatives had explained the process. The researchers found that by connecting the circulatory systems of a younger and older mouse, they were able to arrest and ultimately reverse the aging process. Camp's medical consultants did not completely understand how it worked, just its effects when the donor's DNA had the right obscure markers. And apparently, Dakari was the perfect match, a 1 in 100 million. He suddenly felt revolted at the thought of the old man's blood invading his body, to be revitalized, and began to squirm.
"Dakari, please stop." Eva placed her hand on the boy's left arm. "You'll pull the tubes out."
Dakari twisted his head to see her and scowled in protest.
"Remember, I've got a treat for you today if you're good."
She gave his arm a gentle squeeze. Dakari turned away and tried to relax by watching sailboats slowly drift in and out of the exclusive marina across the bay. Distracted by something on the ceiling screen, Camp was oblivious to the boy's distress. It would take time to completely exchange their blood. Dakari closed his eyes and pretended he was somewhere else.
"I don't want to do this again,"
he complained to Eva as she disconnected the tubes from his arm once the process had been completed.
He winced in pain as he tried to prop himself up on his elbows and glared at Camp. The old man, pumped full of young blood, hopped up and stretched luxuriously.
"You'll do it," Camp countered, "because it's what your family needs you to do to keep them out of that pit I found all of you in. I'd call that a great deal for the inconvenience of a few hours of pain while your body rejuvenates my blood."
He jumped off the transfer bed and rolled down his sleeves, straightened his clothes, then walked out of the room with an exaggerated spring to his step. Eva helped Dakari off the bed.
"Do you need a wheelchair?"
"No, I can do it,"
Dakari insisted stubbornly. He stumbled, but was determined to keep on his feet without help.
"You were good today. I got this for you."
Eva surreptitiously palmed him a small bag of candies, something he was not supposed to eat. He smiled, accepted the candies, then winced as he took a tentative step.
"You look tired, Dakari. Is everything okay?"
His mother interrogated the screen, looking for signs things were not right. The midday sun streamed through the windows behind her, partially silhouetting her face.
"I'm fine, Mom. It's night here. I'm getting ready for bed,"
Dakari explained.
"Are you sure? You look too pale and thin. Are they feeding you enough? Are the treatments making you sick?"
she quizzed.
"I'm okay. Everything is going well. How's Dad, Yash, and Isha?"
Dakari knew the sessions were being monitored, so he kept to the allowed topics. His mother moved closer to the screen, as if it could help her see through the facade he was hiding behind.
"I'm fine,"
he assured her again, trying to hide the body language which said otherwise, and changed the subject.
"What have you been up to?"
"Quite a bit,"
his mother said, changing from a frown to a smile.
"Thanks to Mr. Camp. We're at the ocean in one of his resorts. It's been extremely hot here. They're saying it's another killer heat dome and could last all summer. It's good to get out of the city. And the resort, it's so lovely, right on the ocean. We watched the sunset from the beach every day."
Dakari remembered how unbearably hot Dharavi got and knew that even though his family's new apartment had air conditioning, moving around the city in a heat wave would be insufferable and dangerous, especially for his father.
"Sounds great, Mom."
He shifted in his seat, stifled a grimace, and tried to sound enthusiastic. But after the last parabiosis session, his hips were so sore he could barely stand.
"I'm happy you're all doing so well. Don't worry about me. I'm fine."
His mother leaned in even closer so her face filled the camera.
"Are you sure?"
Dakari had never been good at hiding things from her.
"Really, I'm fine, Mom," he insisted. "It's really nice here."
She leaned back so her eyes could carefully scan the entire screen. Dakari imagined her scrutinizing every pixel that made up his face. Could she see in his face how hard the treatments were on him? He didn't want her to know. He wanted her to be happy. As long as she never had to live in a shack without plumbing or electricity again, he was willing to bear a bit of pain for her and his family's sake.
"I'm living like a king, Mom, in a palace overlooking the sea. Look, everything is so clean and new here. See?"
He picked up the tablet and swung it around his room.
"It's a palace." "I miss you,"
his mother whispered, concern underscoring her words.
"I hope everything is going the way the doctor said it would. I wish you could be here with us."
"I do too."
Dakari pointed the tablet at his window so his mother would see the ocean and not the expression on his face. Several days later, Dakari found himself on the top floor of the villa where Camp had his office. He had been wandering around the complex when he noticed the fire escape had been left unlocked. He knew the floor was out of bounds, but his curiosity overcame his fear of Camp's wrath. Taking his shoes off so he wouldn't be heard, Dakari slunk unobtrusively down an ornately decorated side hall, leading away from the fire escape. Its marble floor was cool on the soles of his feet. It was kept spotless by a fleet of robotic cleaners, which avoided him like he was a piece of furniture as they worked to clean up behind him. Camp only permitted machines into his personal sanctum. The old man was secretive to the point of paranoia, so none of the medical staff or the housekeepers were allowed on the floor. Yet, Dakari could hear Camp talking to someone. The voices were muffled, making the conversation impossible to follow. Curious, he crept silently along the wall until he came to a T-junction. Then, carefully looked around the corner and into the vacant, electric eyes of one of the service bots. He stumbled, jumped backwards, and knocked over a table, sending it crashing to the floor. The sound was deafening as it reverberated down the hall.
"What was that?"
he heard Camp exclaim. Someone scraped a chair across the floor, and footsteps began to echo down the hall. Dakari looked desperately around for a place to hide. The only thing he could find was a shallow alcove for a statue. He slipped in and flattened himself tightly against the rough plaster wall. The thing was so shallow he had to breathe in and angle his feet so they wouldn't be immediately seen. But it would only work if the approaching person stopped at the junction. If they took more than a step or two into the side hall, they would see him, and there was nothing he could do about it. Dakari listened, hands shaking, as the steps came closer, then stopped. He wished he could melt into the wall and did his best to flatten himself against it. Sweat began to trickle down his back. The feet scuffled, stopped, then scuffled again, but didn't come into the side passage.
"Hey, Larry, one of your bots knocked over a table. You should use people, not machines up here," the man called back down the hall.
"I don't trust people," Camp shouted back. "I've made sure the machines aren't smart enough to spy on me. I can't see into a person's mind to know what they're thinking, so I'm okay with the bots occasionally knocking into something. It's a small price to pay for my privacy."
The footsteps receded back down the hall. Dakari waited until he couldn't hold his breath any longer, then exhaled. He used the sound of the service bot struggling to right the table to hide his movement, crept past the junction and down the hall to the room where Camp and the man were talking again.
"It's going to take another 15 years for the singularity to appear," the man explained, matter-of-factly.
"But that's too long, Kirill," Camp complained. "I'm 89, and even with the parabiosis treatment, I'm not sure I'll live that long. I'm already taking so much from the kid. He'll only last another 5 or 6 years, and we haven't found another match yet. My doctors say I might make it to 100 without another Dakari. But that still leaves me almost half a decade short."
"We could try and preserve your brain patterns," Kirill suggested.
"That's pointless, and you know it. We would need something almost as powerful as the singularity. No, I need 5 more years to guarantee my consciousness can be uploaded. Just 5 measly years, that's all I'm asking the universe for, but it doesn't seem to be listening. So I need to take this into my own hands. I'm not willing to trust my post-human existence on the off chance we can find another match. It took nearly 10 years to find the kid. We need to ensure the singularity is reached sooner. Give me a list of companies developing critical foundational technology. We'll pick a few key players, buy into them, and accelerate their programs."
Kirill mumbled an acknowledgement Dakari couldn't make out. Then he heard the man get up to leave and silently crept back down the hall to the fire escape.
"I'm not going,"
Dakari shouted through the locked door of his room.
"You're going to forfeit your contract with Mr. Camp," came a muffled warning from one of the security guards.
Dakari had locked himself in as soon as he got back from his foray on Camp's personal floor. no one appeared to have noticed or cared until the next morning when an assistant came to get him for the next parabiosis session.
"You can't scare me," Dakari taunted. "He can't replace me."
"I'm getting the master key," the guard threatened and stomped off.
"Dakari," Eva knocked gently on the door. "Dakari, please let me in. I just want to talk. I won't take you to the clinic unless you agree to go."
Dakari, eyes reddened from crying, turned away from the window to face the door.
"I'm not ever going to go again," he insisted.
"I don't understand why, Dakari. You've been doing so well, helping out Mr. Camp and your family. That's a good thing to do," Eva encouraged him.
Dakari suddenly swung the door open.
"Except it's killing me. I've only got another 5 or 6 years," he cried.
Eva pushed through into the room, closing the door securely behind her.
"Where did you hear that? You recover within 20 hours of a treatment, and the effects are not cumulative."
"That's not true,"
he insisted, then admitted to Eva he had snuck onto the top floor and overheard Camp and Kirill.
"You must have misunderstood," she tried to assure him. "In 5 or 6 years, you'll be close to adulthood, and your body stops growing. From what I understand, parabiosis only works when the donor is young. It makes sense they'd have to look for someone else then. I'll make some discreet inquiries, but I can assure you I'm right."
Eva took out a Kleenex and handed it to him, waiting for Dakari to wipe away his tears.
"Feeling better?"
He nodded tentatively.
"Okay then, let's get to the clinic before Mr. Camp loses his patience."
Eva took the boy's hand and led him out of the room. Dakari was lying on his bed, head propped up, so he could watch the yachts lazily sail through the bay. After the last session, he felt sicker than usual and wondered if Camp had changed something to siphon away more of his youth even faster. Suspiciously, over the last few days, Dakari had been getting seemingly pointed messages from his family. His brother needed braces. His father needed hearing aids. His older sister would soon need college tuition, and wasn't it great that his arrangement with Mr. Camp would ensure everything was covered? He felt confused and conflicted. Had he been wrong about what he had overheard? Camp had emphasized if he stayed until he was no longer needed, a trust fund would be set up for him and his family. He just had to stay until that day happened. But what was the point if he would only live 5 more years? There was a knock at his door.
"Dakari,"
Eva whispered.
"Dakari, are you in there?"
"Yes," he moaned. "The door's not locked."
He heard the latch turn as Eva came in and sat on the edge of his bed, looking distraught.
"Are you okay?"
he asked. Her face was clouded with concern and something else he had never seen before. Fear.
I did some research, Dakari. I was wrong. I broke into some files I'm not supposed to have access to. It's not entirely understood, but the research on mice suggests... Oh, Dakari, you're going to age too fast. You'll be an old man before you're 20 and die of premature old age.
A mixture of fear and anger surged through the boy. He sat up, clenching his fists.
"I was right," he confirmed. "But if I refuse to do it again, you might recover, or too much damage might have been done already. No one knows,"
Eva admitted, burying her head in her hands. "There's no data on long-term effects if the treatments are stopped prematurely."
What should I do?"
Big tears began to roll down the boy's face.
I really don't know,"
Eva admitted, taking one of Dakari's hands in hers.
"I'll do what I can. I swear, but this is my last day. I quit. I can't be a part of this."
Dakari's back ached more than usual, and his left shoulder throbbed. The last hour spent tucked into a ball in a recycle bin hadn't helped, and he wasn't sure how much longer he could take. Eva had assured him the bins were always moved to the street for collection at 3 in the afternoon. He hadn't wanted to do the morning session, but he knew if he didn't go, they'd be looking for him. This way, although he hadn't had time to recover from the parabiosis, he hoped he would have almost a 24-hour head start before anyone noticed him missing. He barely repressed a scream when his sore shoulder suddenly impacted the hard, plastic side as the bin was loaded onto a cart. The engine of a small garden tractor choked to life and the bin began to rattle forward. Dakari waited until he couldn't hear the machine, waited another few minutes, then dug himself out of the bin. Dropping down into the service lane behind the villa, he looked around. Seeing no one, he began to limp away. 2 days later, he found himself standing, staring at the elaborate iron villa gate, shivering in the rain, rubbing the bandage covering the shunts in his arm. Apparently, he had not yet been spotted by the myriad of security cameras scattered around the outside of the estate. Eva had kept her promise, but by the time he had walked through the back streets to her modest apartment, the building had been overrun by villa security and police. So, he found himself with nowhere to go and no way to disappear in the small French town. He stood in front of the gate, rain dripping off his chin, feeling desperate and trapped, wondering what to do. Finally, mustering his resolve, his hand began to reach out to the intercom. "Dakari," a familiar, kind voice came from the window of a cab hidden in the shadows on the other side of the lane. "You don't have to do this. You have a choice. Come with me." Dakari stared at the new wrinkles on the back of his hand and his arthritic knuckles, and he realized there was only one thing he could do.
Makeshift Stories is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, locally grown, community supported. To get other great APN podcasts, head over to albertapodcastnetwork.com, where you'll find I Love This, You Should Too, a podcast about sharing the things you like with the people you love, regardless of how terrible you think their taste may be. This episode of Makeshift Stories is brought to you by Roomy. Cold drafts, flickering lights, and where's that leak coming from? If you've ever wondered what's really going on in your home, Roomy's Ask a Home Inspector service can help. Connect with a certified professional home inspector by phone or video call and get your questions answered. Roomy will let you know what's easily fixable with a little DIY or when you might need to call in some professional help. Visit roomy.ca, that's R-U-M-I.ca, and book your Ask a Home Inspector appointment today. This episode of Makeshift Stories is also brought to you by Alberta Association of Optometrists, proudly celebrating a century of caring for Albertans. It happens. Many people don't call their optometrist first for urgent eye care when they need it. From spring cleaning mishaps to winter eye infections, if you or your family have an eye emergency, doctors of optometry are trained to diagnose, treat, and prescribe medication. No referral necessary. And just a reminder, Alberta health coverage is available towards your urgent eye care appointment. To find an optometrist in your area, visit optometrists.ab.ca. The Alberta Association of Optometrists represents almost 800 doctors of optometry in over 80 communities across the province. Members are highly trained, regulated health professionals who provide primary eye health and vision care to Albertans. Learn more at optometrists.ab.ca.
Makeshift Stories is released around the beginning and the middle of the month. This month's story was written by Alan V. Hare and read by Mitchell Too. Opening and closing themes were composed and recorded by Matthew Erdman. If you'd like to connect with us, please send an email to makeshiftstories@gmail.com or visit our website at makeshiftstories.com. Links to both are in the show notes. You can help us out by getting your friends to subscribe or follow wherever they listen to audio. Makeshift Stories is released under a Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution No Derivative License, which means you are free to share our stories. Just remember to credit us and don't alter anything.